case of this morning, Carter versus United States.
Morning, may it please the court. I'm Morris Berman, and I'm appointed to represent Leonard Carter, who is present before this court in this matter on an appeal of 2255 matter. The district court issued a certificate of appealability with respect to one issue, the old chief issue, and that is that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to enter into an old chief judge stipulation in this 922G prosecution. And this court expanded that certificate of appealability to include several other issues. And I believe and I hope that the issues for which the certificate was issued and expanded are covered fairly well in the brief. So with respect to the issue I'd like to discuss, and I'd certainly welcome any questions on any of those issues, the one I'd like to address is the one regarding the juvenile adjudication and the use of that for the armed career criminal finding, which of course resulted in Mr. Carter being exposed to a minimum mandatory 15. He ultimately got a sentence of 260 months, and as opposed to the statutory maximum of 10 years for that 922G conviction. By way of background, three juvenile adjudications were used, three armed robbery juvenile adjudications were used. Those were imposed at a time when the Wisconsin Juvenile Code provided that a judgment in a juvenile court proceeding is not a conviction of a crime and shall not impose any civil disabilities ordinarily resulting from the conviction of a crime.
But, you know, of course, that's state law, and I guess I would like to start with the language of 924E, because 922G1 has referred to three previous convictions by somebody for a violent felony, and then there's a definition, a statutory definition of violent felony, which includes any act of juvenile delinquency and so forth that would be punishable by imprisonment for such term if committed by an adult that has various elements. And, you know, obviously Congress can define what it wants regardless of various differences among the states. Why doesn't that statutory definition trump anything Wisconsin was doing and govern up?
Well, I think that 4835 has to be read also in connection with 921A20. I believe what you were referring to, Your Honor, is 924E2B.
E2B.
Anyway,
yeah.
And it says a conviction is also these certain things if committed by a juvenile involving a knife, a gun, etc. The 921A20, I submit, also has to be considered here. And any conviction which has been expunged, set aside, of which a person has been pardoned or has civil rights restored shall not be considered a conviction for purposes of this chapter. The district court assumed that 921A20 applied here, but its decision in saying that these juvenile adjudications could be used for armed career criminal enhancement turned on the fact that civil rights were not restored because they were concededly never taken away. And that's where I contend that the First Circuit's reasoning in Delicato ought to be followed.
But I guess the problem, I mean, I understand your argument about that, but we need to give some content to the decision of Congress to include juvenile adjudications, and juvenile adjudications virtually never have the same effect on civil rights that an adult felony conviction has. That's the whole point of this system of juvenile adjudication. So it seems to me your reading of 921 pretty much reads that other language out of 924.
Well, I don't believe it does. I have not found anything in this circuit which directly addresses the issue. I'm aware of only one unpublished decision in the Sixth Circuit which deals fairly directly with it, with a juvenile adjudication which was expunged. Glazer, which of course is mentioned in Dollar, deals in passing with 48.35 in the sense that it deals with laws which restore civil rights as a general matter. And I just don't believe that there is a principal difference for treating this juvenile adjudication where rights were never taken away differently from an adult conviction where they are restored either by statute or by discharge. And so I just believe that the reasoning of Indelicato here, and I think it would be new law in the circuit, I don't believe that there is any definitive decision which governs this. And there is a split in the circuits, at least as to how these adult convictions should be used. It's not necessarily the case that juvenile adjudications would not take away civil rights. In Wisconsin now, under the revamping of the juvenile code, a person like Mr. Carter would be subject to prosecution for being a felon in possession, and it could be used in recidivist statutes. But that wasn't the case in the 1993-1994 version. So unless the court has any further questions on that issue. The other issue, which the district court issued a certificate of appealability on, was the old chief issue. And we contend that this met both prongs of the Strickland test.
The government argues that this was an instance where there was no evidence that he was willing to, we don't know why counsel refused to stipulate, no evidence that he was willing to do that.
Right, and all the record reveals is that the government instigated or initiated an attempt to enter into this stipulation. We don't know why. And one way the court could deal with that issue is certainly Rule 8 of the rules governing these 2255 proceedings is to hold an evidentiary hearing on it. The district court went directly to the second prong of the two-prong Strickland test.
Right,
It just said it wasn't enough. You know, it didn't matter. It wasn't prejudicial. Certainly take issue with that. And I pointed out in the brief, I believe it's pages 12 and 13 of the brief, the use to which the government made of these prior convictions. In the closing argument, it said the government said that Ms. Carter knows about guns, he knows about drugs. This is a case involving finding of drugs of about a quarter ounce of marijuana. Leaving that aside, he knows about guns, he knows about dope. These guns were designed to kill people, they were loaded, etc.
And Carter admitted to a certain amount of this, though. I mean, how could this extra old chief problem have added to the difficulty he was already in?
Well, my position is that if there had been an old chief stipulation, it could have also been simply elicited from Carter that he had been convicted of a prior felony on direct exam. Not the nature of those felonies. The judgments themselves went in. The judgments that he had been convicted of recklessly endangering safety and that he'd been convicted of a cocaine distribution offense. The nature of those convictions was before the jury. The evidence here was not as overwhelming as the government contends here. This was a place where he stayed on occasion. There was evidence that another person stayed there who was a gang member who, by testimony of a witness, was seen carrying around a gun, albeit not necessarily a specific gun. And
you knew the make, model, caliber of these guns.
He disputed that version of the detective's recounting of
the statement that the detective said in the interview that's without having been told what they were, identified them. Correct?
That's what she said, and I believe he contested that version of it. So, granted, that became a credibility issue, making perhaps more important the fact that the jury has before it this issue or this evidence that he's committed these dangerous offenses in the past or assaultive offenses in the past, and he's been convicted of being a drug dealer in the past. So I do believe that both prongs of that Strickland test were met, or at least there should be an evidentiary hearing on why that stipulation wasn't there, because for the life of me, I can't think of a strategic reason to not do it. In every 922G case I've been involved in, first thing I'm running at is getting that old chief stipulation.
Okay, you're about to run out of time, so if you want to stay.
Unless the court has any further questions, I'll save my time. Thank you.
Okay. Jacob?
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honor. I think the strategic reason that we're talking about with Old Chief and not stipulating to the felony status is if the defendant had decided to testify, and he did testify in this case, under 609, his felony conviction would come in. Typically, anyway, under the law of the circuit, and what is typically done in the Eastern District, the name of the offense, the date of the offense, the sentence, those kinds of basic facts about the felony record would be admissible. And so in this case, what happened, and at some level I think it was beneficial to the defendant, his felony convictions came in during the government's case in chief in a pretty antiseptic type of a way. The detective,
we don't have the trial transcript in this case, though. I'm finding it very hard to figure out how antiseptic or non-antiseptic if all of this was.
If that's the case, I apologize to the Court, and I would certainly move to have that made a part of the record. I have to say, at all times, I assumed it was a part of the record. It's a part of the district court record. But the way it came in was through the testimony of a detective, Carol Starr, who was shown copies of the certified judgment rolls. She indicated that he had been convicted, essentially the date and the name of the conviction. On cross-examination, then, by defense counsel, he asked her, were the guns at issue in this felon in possession case in any way a part of or involved, as far as you know, in any of those priors? And the detective, of course, had to say no. Then, when he testified, the government was willing and did enter into a stipulation so that the only thing that was said during his testimony at the very beginning was the party stipulates that he has felony convictions, and that was it. So that he didn't have to sort of take the brunt of those felony convictions in front of the jury on the stand. They were already out and a part of the record during the government's case in chief in, a pretty antiseptic way. There was no references, to the facts underlying those convictions. But the bottom line here is those convictions were very likely to come in, and the defense attorney certainly had to know that if they had made the decision that the defendant was going to testify, and as I said, he did in this case.
Another thing I wanted to bring up, Judge Randa, in his order, drops a footnote on page 2, which is the third page of the appendix. This goes to the question whether the 2255 kind of moots the whole question about his direct appeal. And in one important respect, it clearly does not. Because on direct appeals, people can raise Fourth Amendment issues. It happens all the time.
Right.
I'm sure you know.
Absolutely.
And of course, on 2255, they're facing, as you correctly point out in your brief, in this circuit, Holman against Page,
mm-hmm.
and they're in any event facing Stone against Powell issues. They're facing mm-hmm. all sorts of issues. A 2255 is by no means a substitute for a direct appeal on a Fourth Amendment issue.
I would agree with that.
And so in that respect, to the extent there is a Fourth Amendment challenge to the search warrant floating around in this case, the fact of the 2255 route does seem prejudicial to me.
Well, I think that the procedural history of that Fourth Amendment claim, though, needs to be looked at. Of course, and I think the Court would agree with me, to the extent that you're talking about an appeal of an ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to raise it, that's another
issue. That's a whole different issue. I certainly agree.
Right.
That's different.
But with respect to the Fourth Amendment issue per se, the record, I think, is very clear here. The defense attorney files a very sort of generalized Fourth Amendment motion, just saying, I'd like to suppress any evidence that was taken from my client sort of ever. And the government responded saying, we can't respond to this without some indication of what you're trying to move to suppress, otherwise the motion should be denied. In response to that, and it is in the record, defense counsel filed a letter indicating that at the time that he filed that motion, he didn't have all the discovery. And so he was just trying to preserve any motion that he might have, because we work on a fairly quick motion schedule in the Eastern District. He's got 10 days, basically, from the date of arraignment to get those motions filed. And if he didn't have all the discovery, presumably he's just trying to generally preserve those issues. Then no further motion was filed. And the magistrate judge issued his recommendation indicating without anything further filed, there should be the suppression motion to the extent there's a motion should be dismissed. But I think that letter makes pretty clear why the generalized motion was filed, and that if he was trying to attack the search warrant, either another motion would have been filed or something more particular would have needed to be filed. Then no objection. I mean, the magistrate judge's recommendation points that out. It's a very generalized motion. I can't tell what you're trying to do, so it's denied. No objection is filed. And so I think the inference, while there's nothing in the record that says I'm no longer filing a Fourth Amendment motion to suppress on the search warrant grounds, I think the record is clear enough through that letter why that generalized motion was filed. And as I addressed in the brief, the search warrant is in the defendant's appendix. It clearly points out that there was a drug buy from that residence within 72 hours of the search being conducted. I don't think there's ever been an allegation that Leon would not have saved that search warrant, so that even if the court would get into a probable cause analysis and find that there wasn't probable cause. And so for that reason, I would submit that the counsel was not ineffective for failing. The counsel should not have to file a suppression motion in every single case. Obviously, he or she has a job to do in assessing the case and the merits of such a motion. And here, with a valid search warrant, and the kind of specifics that were found in that warrant, a strategic decision was there to be made, and I would submit was made by counsel. If the court has no further questions on the Armed Career Criminal determination, as I say in my brief, I think there is a pretty clear statutory plain language construction of 924E as you walked through.
But why is it, I mean, that juvenile convictions are uniquely not subject to this more general rule about restoration of civil rights?
I think it is because of the plain language of the statute that when 924E defines violent felony, it uses two disjunctive terms.
But the first half of that disjunctive just says felony, and then you go back to 921 and you say, well, but then if there's restoration of civil rights, you can, you know, it's an exception to the rule. Basically.
Right. Well, the first half of that uses the term, I think, crime. I don't have a statute
any crime,
but punishable by a term.
Right.
But I would say that is definitely a term of art in the firearms statute, and that's why 921A20 exists. That's not the only place in the firearms statute that term appears. And for that reason, 921, that is definitely a term of art that is specifically defined by 921A20. Mm-hmm. But then Congress uses the word or, act of juvenile delinquency, and goes on, as you said, to define it. In 924E2C, it then says that the word conviction, which is at the top of the statute, includes acts of juvenile delinquency. So it's not as if they're using that crime punishable by a term of 1 year to help define act of juvenile delinquency. Those are two separate types of convictions or adjudications that Congress is trying to include within that term violent felony. And for that reason, I think that to use 921A20 as some sort of filter on juvenile adjudications just runs contrary to the plain language of 924E. I would ask that the defendant's conviction and sentence obviously be affirmed and the district court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you. You have a very small amount of time, but we will hear.
Well, a Leon challenge was made in my brief to the adequacy of that search warrant. But I agree with the court that particular issue was not mooted by virtue of counsel being appointed to represent Mr. Carter on his 2255 matter. As to the balance of the arguments concerning the Armed Career Criminal, I simply rely on the brief and the cases cited there and urge that those juvenile adjudications for which no civil disability was imposed should not have been used to determine armed career criminal status for Mr. Cousins. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And you were appointed, and we thank you very much for your